The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. This is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call. It is Friday, November the 25th, 2011, and we are coming to you live from Singapore. Well, today I have two very powerful reports for you. One comes courtesy of Anne McKiffin, which is a piece from Bill Black, talking to a group of the Occupy Wall Street Los Angeles contingent. And I thought we would start with that. It's one of the best, if not the best, speech I have ever heard him give. I hope you will feel the same way. So without further ado, let us go to Bill Black in Los Angeles.
Okay, so I'm coming with a message of hope, actually. In the savings and loan crisis, which was 1/70th the size of this crisis, our agency made over 10,000 criminal referrals, and that resulted in the conviction on felony grounds of over 1,000 elites in what were designated as major cases. And to pick up on what's just been said, this is not some sidelight to economics. This is why we have recurrent, intensifying crises, is these epidemics of fraud led from the C-suite, from the CEOs and the CFOs. The savings and loan crisis, the inevitable National Commission said fraud was invariably present at the typical large failure. In the Enron era, always frauds from the very top of the organization. And in this crisis, the frauds came from the top of the organization again. But what's different in this crisis? In this crisis, the same agency that I worked with that made over 10,000 criminal referrals in a tinier crisis made zero criminal referrals. They got rid of the entire function. And so there are zero convictions of anybody in the elite ranks of Wall Street. And if they can defraud us with impunity, then they will cause crisis after crisis, and they will produce maximum inequality. The group that has the audacity to refer to itself as the productive class is the largest destroyer of lives, of jobs, and of wealth of any group ever produced in this world. They wiped out 6 million existing jobs and 5 to 6 million jobs that would have been created. As you've heard, they've left 26 million Americans wanting full-time work with no ability to find that work. If you look at just losses in the household sector, it is $11 trillion. A trillion is $1,000 billion. And then they had the nerve to say they are the productive class, and not this journalist, but what we get as faux journalism today repeats this endlessly as if it were a fact, that they create jobs, they destroy jobs, they are mass destroyers of jobs. I told you I would bring you a message of hope. I will disagree a little bit with a fact pattern about the Reagan administration and re-regulation on savings and loans, because that's where I was. I will tell you this. Everybody opposed our re-regulation of the industry. The big deregulation bill, the equivalent of the repeal of Glass-Steagall and such, occurred in 1982, became effective in 1983. By November 1983, we were already re-regulating the savings and loan industry. And we were called re-regulators because that was the greatest swear word the Reagan administration believed existed, to call people re-regulators. But this was not partisan. A majority of the members of the House, at the time it was controlled by Democrats, co-sponsored a resolution saying, do not go forward with re-regulation. Five U.S. senators, who became known as the Keating Five, because of the most infamous fraud of that era, got them together. And who, by the way, did that Charles Keating, that fraud, use to recruit the Keating Five? Brought them as a lobbyist to walk the streets of the Senate, the halls of the Senate? A guy named Alan Greenspan, who also put in writing that Lincoln's savings posed no foreseeable risk of loss. It was only the most expensive failure, a 3,000 position error. And after he got everything wrong in the most important issues he had ever dealt with, after that fact, we named him chairman of the Federal Reserve, because we promote incompetence if it helps the 1%. The Reagan administration was so outraged that we were closing insolvent savings and loans with great political support that the Office of Management and Budget threatened to file a criminal referral against the head of our agency on the grounds that he was closing too many insolvent banks. We have that problem recently. You see Geithner out trying to close the big, powerful banks. And the Reagan administration tried to appoint two members. There are only three members running the place. So this would have given control to Charles Keating, the most notorious fraud in the savings and loan crisis, selected two individuals to run the agency that would then not regulate him. One of them got knocked out on ambiguous political grounds, and the other ones I had to blow the whistle to get him to resign in disgrace. But of course, they didn't prosecute him. We can prosecute these frauds. The Federal Housing Finance Administration has just filed complaints saying 17 of the largest banks in America committed massive fraud, endemic fraud, and that there is a paper trail proving that they did so. So where is the Justice Department? Why is it not indicting these clear frauds? When you are told no one could have seen this crisis coming, ask them about the subprime crisis of 1990 to 1991. It's a trick question. As all good things do in the world of fraud, this one started in Orange County, where you had significant people making liars' loans. Now remember, it is the lenders who put the lies in liars' loans, not the borrowers. We know this empirically. And we stopped that because that was insane as regulators. So guess what happened? The leading folks making liars' loans gave up their federal charter, gave up federal deposit insurance, and became a mortgage bank for the sole purpose of escaping regulation. And they changed their name, and some of you will recognize this name, to AmeriQuest. AmeriQuest, the leading predatory lender that, in addition to making liars' loans every day of the week, targeted minorities to destroy that wealth that you just heard about. They targeted Latinos, they targeted blacks, and they were caught and they were caught three times doing this, and the Justice Department refused to prosecute. Instead, they settled for $400 million, and guess what happened to the head of AmeriQuest? Did he, A, resign in disgrace? B, was he indicted? Or C, did we make him our ambassador to the Netherlands? Got it in one. Now, how hard is this to figure out? Why do you think we made him our ambassador to the Netherlands? Because he was the leading political contributor to the President of the United States of America. And that's bad, but what comes next is far worse. Remember, this is the most notorious fraud in the nation. It targets minorities. Everybody knows it does so. Two entities rush to acquire these personnel and this business. And their names? Citicorp and Washington Mutual, who become two of the most notorious frauds in all of this. So time-wise, I'll stop here, but the case is when we prosecuted, we had a 90% conviction rate. When they have the best criminal defense lawyers in the world and they spend money like water to protect the CEO from going to prison. So when they tell you no one can stop this, it is utter nonsense. Leave you with these statistics. The FBI warned of this in September 2004 in open testimony. It warned expressly that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, and it predicted it would cause a financial crisis. If that's not enough, the industry's own anti-fraud experts in 2006, in writing, went to every mortgage banker in America and virtually every other lender, said three things. Stated income loans are an open invitation to fraudsters. The incidence of fraud in such loans is 90%, 90. They are all fraudulent. And third, these loans deserve the phrase used by the industry behind closed door. They are liar's loans because they are pervasively fraudulent. How big did they get? Well, what did the industry do after it was warned? Did it stop making these loans? No. It massively increased the amount of these loans such that by 2006, one out of every three home loans in America was a liar's loan. And that's why we have a crisis, and it came from the very top of these organizations, and it went through, as the FHFA said in its complaint, the largest banks in the world were endemically fraudulent. It is not a few rotten apples. It is an orchard of one percenters who are rotten to the core.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, what on earth can I add to that? You know, I have to wonder why Bill Black has not already been picked up by the authorities and told to run the current rage of arrests and prosecutions. But I suppose he'd do too good a job for the current pack of liars and thieves. So we just have to wait. All right, let me give you my information, please. To start with, the toll-free number here is 888-874-4888. Again, that is a toll-free number for you, please, to call in at any time. It is 888-874-4888. If you would like to email me in, that would be rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my direct line through Sarasota, Florida, if you would like to call in. It is 941-441-1682. And if you would please leave a message for me and your name with a phone number, I will call you back if I don't happen to be around when you call. But you may, of course, call any time on the 24-hour clock, because I am 12 or 13 hours ahead of you, so therefore it really doesn't make any difference when you call. There is a high chance I will be likely to answer. Once again, the number is 941-441-1682. All right, well, by the way, before I forget, the Bill Black recording came actually courtesy of Peter Marciano. I had seen this several times. I hadn't listened to it. But when Peter sends me something, I pay attention. So I did, in fact, listen to it. Very fortunate that he did send me that link, because I might well not have. Bill Black has been doing the rounds recently. He's been giving a lot of interviews on radio and on TV, so I might have missed this one. So thanks, Peter. Keep it clean. All right, so just before we move on, let me remind you all, please, ladies and gentlemen, of the meetup group, that the Richard Martin meetup group that will be meeting next Sunday, not this Sunday, next Sunday, the 4th of December at 2 p.m. That's the Richard Martin meetup group meeting at the George Street Ale House in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That's the George Street Ale House, which was an old speakeasy, I'm given to understand. And the address is 378 George Street. Surprise, surprise. 378 George Street, New Brunswick. And Susan will be moderating. She has taken over from Lou. And I would be very grateful if you would call her to let her know you're coming, so that she can organize the right number of tables and chairs, etc. Susan's number is area code 202-246-5131. Again, that's area code 202-246-5131, and that is Susan, who will be moderating on the 4th of December at 2 p.m., the next Richard Martin meetup group. So, we now come to the second rather powerful piece that I shall read you. It comes courtesy of Anne McKiffin. It is, quite frankly, a prize piece from Paul Craig Roberts, and it's entitled The Roads to War and Economic Collapse. And I may say that it's not often that I can say that I agree with every word, every comma, every period of a piece that I read to you, ladies and gentlemen, but please take this as if they were words from my very own being. Every single word. I can only say I wish I had Roberts's gift of expression. So, here goes. November the 23rd, 2011. The day before the Thanksgiving holiday brought three extraordinary news items. One was the report on the Republican presidential campaign debate. One was the Russian president's statement about his country's response to Washington's missile bases surrounding his country. And one was the failure of a German government bond auction. As the prestitute media will not inform us of what any of this means, let me try. With the exception of Ron Paul, the only candidate in either party qualified to be the President of the United States, the rest of the Republican candidates are even worse than Obama, a president who had the country behind him but sold out the American people to special interests. No newly elected president in memory, neither John F. Kennedy nor Ronald Reagan, had the extraordinary response to his election as a Barack Obama. a record-breaking number of people braved the cold to witness his swearing-in ceremony. The mall was filled for miles distant from the capital with Americans who could not see the ceremony except televised on giant screens. Obama had convinced the electorate that he would end the wars, stop the violation of law by the U.S. government, end the regime of illegal torture, close the torture prison of Guantanamo, and attend to the real needs of the American people, rather than stuff the pockets of the military security complex with taxpayers' money. Once in office, Obama renewed and extended the Bush-Cheney neoconservative wars. He validated the Bush regime's assaults on the U.S. Constitution. He left Wall Street in charge of U.S. economic policy. He absolved the Bush regime of its crimes. And he assigned to the American people the financial cost necessary to preserve the economic welfare of the mega-rich. One would think such a totally failed president would be easy to defeat. Given an historic opportunity, the Republican Party has put before the electorate the most amazingly stupid and vile collection of prospects, with the exception of Ron Paul, who doesn't have the party's support, that Americans have ever seen. In the November 22nd presidential debate, so-called, the candidates, with the exception of Ron Paul, revealed themselves as a collection of ignorant warmongers who support the police state. Gingrich and Kaine said that Muslims, quote, want to kill us all, and that all of us will be in danger for the rest of our lives. Bachmann said that the American puppet state, Pakistan, is, quote, more than an existential threat. Bachmann has no idea what is more than an existential threat. However, it sounded heavy, like an intellectual thing to say for the candidate who previously declared the long-defunct Soviet Union to be today's threat to the U.S. Unfortunately for Americans and the world, the U.S. electorate lacks the intelligence and awareness of their plight, as denizens of a police state to elect Ron Paul, the last defender, together with Representative Dennis Kucinich of the U.S. Constitution. Nevertheless, there would be a silver lining in one of the Republican morons being elected president of, quote, the world's only superpower. Once the rest of the world realized that a war-crazed idiot had his or her finger on the nuclear button, the rest of the world would organize and close down the Washington horror before it destroys life on Earth. Any sentient American who watched or read about the Republican presidential debate must wonder what there is to be thankful for as the national holiday approaches. The Russian government, which prefers to use its resources for the economy rather than for the military, has decided that it has been taking too many risks in the name of peace. The day before Thanksgiving, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said in a televised address to the Russian people that if Washington goes ahead with its planned missile bases surrounding Russia, Russia will respond with new nuclear missiles of its own, which will target the American bases and European capital cities. The president of Russia said that the Russian government had asked Washington for legally binding guarantees that the American missile bases are not intended as a threat to Russia, but that Washington has refused to give such guarantees. Medvedev's statement is perplexing. What does he mean if Washington goes ahead? The American missile and radar bases are already in place. Russia is already surrounded. Is Medvedev just now aware of what is already in place? Russia's and China's slow response to Washington's aggression can only be understood in the context of the two countries' experience with communism. The sufferings of Russians and Chinese under communism was extreme, and the thinking part of those populations saw America as the ideal of political life. This delusion still controls the mentality of progressive thinkers in Russia and China. It might prove to be a disaster for Russia and China that the countries have citizens who are aligned with the U.S. belief in Washington's trustworthiness, even pervades the Russian government, which apparently, according to Medvedev's statement, would be reassured by a legally binding guarantee from Washington. After the massive lies told by Washington in the 21st century, weapons of mass destruction, Al-Qaeda connections, Iranian nukes, why would anyone put any credence in a legally binding guarantee from Washington? The guarantee would mean nothing. How could it be enforced? Such a guarantee would simply be another deceit in Washington's pursuit of world hegemony. The day prior to Thanksgiving also brought another extraordinary development: the failure of a German government bond auction, an unparalleled event. Why would Germany, the only member of the European Union with financial rectitude, not be able to sell 35% of its offerings of 10-year bonds? Germany has no debt problems, and its economy is expected, by European Union and United States authorities, to bear the lion's share of the bailout of the European Union member countries that do lack financial rectitude. I suspect that the answer to this question is that the failure of the German government's bond auction was orchestrated by the U.S., by European Union authorities, especially the European Central Bank and private banks, in order to punish Germany for obstructing the purchase of EU member countries' sovereign debt by the European Central Bank. The German government has been trying to defend the terms on which Germany gave up control over its own currency and joined the European Union. By insisting on the legality of the agreements, Germany has been standing in the way of the ECB behaving as the US Federal Reserve and monetizing the debt of member governments. From the beginning, the European Union was a conspiracy against Germany. If Germany remains in the European Union, Germany will be destroyed. It will lose its political and economic sovereignty, and its economy will be bled in behalf of the fiscally irresponsible members of the European Union. If Greeks will not submit to the tyranny, why should Germans? Very true. Thank you very much for that, Anne McKithen. And thank you, Paul Craig Roberts. This is something that needs to be said more often, ladies and gentlemen. And frankly, Paul Craig Roberts is on my list of must-reads, and I must have overlooked this particular one because it's just come out, or maybe it just came out after I last checked. I don't know. But anyway, again, thank you, Anne. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed what I had to say, and as I mentioned at the beginning, I am entirely in favor of every word that I read to you today. All right, well, we are up at the half-hour mark, so I think we'll take a break, and then I'll be right back. Okay, well, I think we're back, and I thought that, you know, you get a lot of what I have to say, what I have to think, and I try to bring in a number of people's ideas as well to the mix. But from time to time, I like to take a back seat and allow others to give you their opinion of what the future holds entirely from their own perspective. And I'm going to do that right now, and I'm going to let some of the world's finest minds let rip on the wake-up call. So if you are ready and sitting back in your favorite chair and you are set, let's go. First up, let's take Credit Suisse's fixed income research unit. This is what they have to say. We seem to have entered the last days of the euro as we currently know it. That doesn't make a breakup very likely, but it does mean some extraordinary things will almost certainly need to happen, probably by mid-January, to prevent the progressive closure of all the eurozone sovereign bond markets, potentially accompanied by escalating runs on even the strongest banks. Okay, that was Credit Suisse. Now we take Willem Buiter, who's the chief economist at Citigroup. Time is running out fast. I think we have maybe a few months, it could be weeks, it could be days, before there is a material risk of a fundamentally unnecessary default by a country like Spain or Italy, which would be a financial catastrophe, dragging the European banking system and North America with it. Now, do remember that these people are very prestigious people, the top of their class, as it were, and so you might want to take quite seriously what they say. But before we continue, we have Jerry in Queens, who wants to talk about the stock market, the economy, and what would happen to both of them if we went to war with Iran. Jerry, the floor is yours. Take over.
Good morning, Richard.
Jerry, you're breaking up. Hello, are you there? Jerry, you're going to have to call back if you're listening to this, but if you do so, please use a landline. I think you're on a cell phone, which may have some poor reception. Anyway, until Jerry gets back, let me continue with Jim Reed of Deutsche Bank, who says, if you don't think Merkel's tone will change, then our investment advice is to dig a hole in the ground and hide. That's short, sharp, and sweet, isn't it? Then we come to one of my favorites, who is David Rosenberg, a senior economist at Gluskin Sheff in Toronto. I used to have much more to say about him when his daily comments were free. He now charges $1,000 a year. I think I will pass on that one. Okay. Well, before we come to Dave's comment, let's take it again from Jerry. Hi, Jerry. Back again. How are you doing?
Good. All right. Thank you, Richard. Yeah, I've been listening to the show, heard what you talk about shorting the market. What would happen, because there's so much talk now about possible military action against Iran and Syria and others, would that be the final knockout punch to the economy and the stock market, or would that actually make it go up?
Well, I've got some news for you, Jerry. If nobody else has told you this, I'm here to tell you right now. Nobody is going to war with Iran, okay? It ain't going to happen. Iran is a very big, a powerful country. It is very sophisticated. They've got a lot of weapon systems. They can do a lot of harm, and they will. And I assure you that if a single bomb is lobbed towards Iran, there will be hell to pay in the Middle East. Everything that is being said about it is all hot air. It's smoke and mirrors. It is not going to happen. Now, I don't often make comments quite as sharp and definitive as that, but this is a time, I'm glad you brought it up, Jerry, because it needs to be said, and America has absolutely no intention of starting a war, neither does Israel. And furthermore, if there is a war, a world war, including China, Iran will be on America's side. So none of this makes any sense. And in order to do justice to your question, Jerry, I would say that if there was, in the unlikely event that there were hostilities, it would not affect the market that much. probably go down for a couple of days, 3 days, if it was in a bull market, and then it would go on back up again. But what you have here is a bear market. So when I say it wouldn't affect the market, what I would tell you is that the market would simply go on going down as opposed to going up. And if you want a precedent for that, you could look at 9/11, where everybody, of course, said that 9/11 caused the market to collapse. Not true. The market had already been going down for 4.5 months before 9/11. All the market did, once it reopened after those few days of hiatus, was to continue on in the same direction it had been doing before. And then, I may tell you, there was a massive rally, which of course surprised everybody, but these market moves really have very little to do with immediate fundamentals. They have to do with long-term fundamentals, yes. But when certain things happen, for example, which are viewed negatively all within a bull market, like the assassination of Kennedy in 1963, then the market may pay lip service for 2 or 3 days. But just like in November 1963, the market will simply turn around and go back on as though nothing had happened. So I hope that answers your question. Let me know if there's anything else you need to know.
Well, I know you're a big proponent of shorting the market and not being in stocks right now. Has that
correct?
Have you changed on that? Because it seems like the stock market is just like it's out of control freight train, but it just keeps going up, you know, except for lately.
Jerry, you must have been asleep for the last few days or weeks. The market has been going down. The market hit its recent high on the 27th of October, which is almost exactly a month ago, and since then, give or take a few days of rally, the market has been going down. And actually, if you really want to know, Jerry, the bear market took over again on what I always call Bin Laden Death Day, the day that they kindly came in and put an end to Bin Laden, who was in fact weaponless in a room. And they killed him anyway. That was on the 2nd of May, the very same day on which the market topped out. So we've been going at this now for several months, and only in recent days we've seen a very severe downdraft in the market, which to me confirms the existence of a bear market, and I think we will be going down for a very long time to come yet.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thanks for calling, Jerry. Nice to talk to you. So where were we? Dave Rosenberg, that's right, the senior economist at Gluskin Sheff in Toronto, has this to say. Lenders are finding it difficult to finance their day-to-day operations with their short-term funding. This is a lot like 2008, but with more twists. Okay. Then we have Christian Strack, the head of credit research for PIMCO, which is the largest bond fund operation in the world, and he has this to say. This is just a repeat of what we saw in 2008 when everyone wanted to see toxic assets off the bank's balance sheets. So then we come to our friend Paul Krugman of the New York Times, one of my least beloved commentators, always wrong, who has this to say. At this point, I guess soaring rates on Italian debt leading to a gigantic bank run, both because of solvency fears about Italian banks given a default and because of fear that Italy will end up leaving the euro. This leads to an emergency bank closing, and once that happens, a decision to drop the euro and install the new lira. Next stop, France. Well, actually, I kind of agree with him there. I think that's a very likely scenario. Paul Hickey of Bespoke Investment Group. More and more, we are hearing anecdotal comments from individual and professionals that this is the most difficult environment that they have ever experienced, as the market is like a fish flopping around after being taken out of the water. Okay, and then we have Bob Janjua, Nomura International. Germany appears to be adamant that full political and fiscal integration over the next decade, nothing substantive will happen over the short term in my view, is the only option, and European central bank monetization is no longer possible. I really think it is clear and simple. And if I am wrong, and the ECB does a U-turn and agrees to unlimited monetization, I'll simply wait for the inevitable knee-jerk rally to fade before reloading my short risk positions. Even if Germany and the ECB somehow agree to unlimited monetization, I believe it will do nothing to fix the insolvency and lack of growth in the Eurozone. It will just result in a major destruction of the European Central Bank's balance sheet, which will force an ECB recap. At that point, I think Germany and its northern partners would walk away. Markets always want short, sharp, simple solutions. Well, I agree with that too. Dan Ackerson, CEO of none other than General Motors. The 2008 recession, which was a credit bubble that manifested itself through primarily the real estate market, that was a serious stress. This is much more serious. Well, I guess you would say that, wouldn't you, Dan? Your stock price is falling through the floor. Then we come to Francesco Gazzarelli of Goldman Sachs. Pressures on euro area sovereign bond markets have progressively intensified and spread like wildfire. Jim Rogers, who I've quoted many a time on this show. In 2002, it was bad. In 2008, it was worse. And 2012 or 2013 is going to be worse still. Be careful. Excellent advice from Jim Rogers. Dr. Pippa Malmgren, the president and founder of Principalis Asset Management, who once worked in the White House as an advisor to President Bush. Market forces are increasingly determining what the options are and foreclosing on options policymakers thought they had. One option, which is now under discussion, involves permitting a country to temporarily leave the euro, return to its native currency, devalue, commit to returning to the euro at a better debt-to-GDP ratio, a better exchange rate, and a better growth trajectory, and yet not sacrifice its European Union membership. I would like to say, for the record, that this is precisely the thought process that I expected to evolve. But when I proposed this possibility back in 2009 and again in September 2010, I had a 100% response from clients and others that this was impossible, and many felt it was ridiculous. They may be right, but this is the current state of the discussion. The Handelsblatt in Germany has reported this conversation, but wrongly assumes that the country that will exit is Germany. I think that Germany will have to exit if the southern European states do not. Germany's preference is to stay in the euro and have the others drop out. The problem has been the Germans could not convince the others to walk away. But now market pressures are forcing someone to leave. Germany is pushing for that someone to be Italy. They hope that this would be a one-off exception not to be repeated by any other country. Obviously, though, if Italy leaves the euro and reverts to the lira, then the markets will immediately and forcefully attack Spain, Portugal, and even whatever is left of the already savaged Greeks. These countries will not be able to compete against a devalued Greece or Italy when it comes to tourism or even infrastructure. But the principal target will be France. The three largest French banks have roughly 450 billion euros of exposure to Italian debt. So, further sovereign defaults are certainly inevitable, but that is true under any scenario.
growth and austerity will not do the trick, as Zero Hedge rightly points out. Ultimately, I will not be at all surprised to see Europe's banking system shut for days while the losses and payments issues are worked out. People forget that the term bank holiday was invented in the 1930s, when the banks were shut for exactly the same reason. End of quote. Good advice there, Pippa. Keep it up. Daniel Clifton, a policy strategist with Stratagas Research Partners on the potential for more downgrades of U.S. debt, has this to say. We would expect further downgrades. A first downgrade from Moody's and Fitch, and possibly a second downgrade from S&P. Then comes Warren Buffett on the problems in the Eurozone. The system, as presently designed, has revealed a major flaw. And that flaw won't be corrected just by words. Europe will either have to come closer together, or there will have to be some other rearrangement, because this system is not working. So then we have David Kostin, equity strategist for Goldman Sachs, who says, the wide range of possible outcomes on both the super committee process and the unstable political economy in Europe drives our view that investors should assume the worst while hoping for the best. And finally, Mark Mobius, the head of the Emerging Markets Desk at Templeton Asset Management. There is definitely going to be another financial crisis around the corner. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what to do, what to make of all this advice? The answer, I would say, is fairly obvious. When you get that much unanimity of opinion over things which are going to happen, the chances are that they are probably right, and the chances in this particular case are that if you short the stock market, you will probably make a lot of money. So I think that what I've done for you by bringing together all these people is probably a fairly valuable exercise, because it is usually quite difficult to get that number of people talking negatively about the economy all herded together in a group. And so that would be my advice to you. Now remember, shorting the market is a difficult process. You have to find the stocks to short, and you have to hopefully find the right entry point. But at this moment, so many technical support levels have been breached in different markets worldwide, that I would say you're in fairly good in good company if you do decide to short here. All right, we have an emailed question from Al Berry, who's just written in saying, "Dear Richard, if Spain and Italy default, how would that affect United States Treasury bills? Thank you, Al Berry." Well, I think that recent experience has shown us that the United States is really going its own way when it comes to the bond market. Germany was going its own way until yesterday, when they had this appalling subscription or lack of subscription to its newly placed bonds. Most of the European countries have bond prices that are falling quite sharply against the German price, and most are going in a different direction to the United States, where you will see that bond prices have risen quite sharply over the last few months, despite the problems of the world. And I think that as long as the stock market continues to fall, there's a fairly good chance that bond prices will remain high. But at one point, there is going to be a realization worldwide, Al, that the United States is not the secure country that everybody wants to think it is, that large swaths of the American economy are not going to be able to fulfill their obligations to their bondholders. Bond prices will collapse, interest rates will soar,
And my thinking is that at that point there will be very serious problems within the United States bond market. Now, this is one of the reasons why I always suggest buying United States Treasury bills, which are short-term, because then whatever happens to the bond market, your short-term maturities will save you from any losses, because the United States will reimburse you, will pay you, will compensate you at the end of the period of your investment in United States Treasury bills at par, at 100 on the dollar. So you really have very little to risk by buying Treasury bills. As soon as you start going out into longer-dated paper, you do risk what I have just described, you know, something like the possibility that we will see a collapse in the bond market. And then if you held bonds and you needed to redeem them before maturity, you could be looking at quite a sizable loss. Anyway, hopefully that's answered your question, Al. And we have a few minutes left, so I thought I would take a couple of emails. One, of course, comes from Steve Kruger, the inevitable rant, but nevertheless an interesting and valuable rant, and here it comes. Richard, the solution of the ruling one percenters is obvious. It's time to reduce the population, lighten the load, geezers out of the pool. The ruling elite have not kept it a secret. It's inscribed on the massive Georgia Guidestone. A population of 500 million is our keeper's ideal number. When you hit the fourth quarter of your life, you're walking around with a bullseye on your back. When our dog got old and felt the ravages of time, we didn't pull the plug on her. I can only hope they extend me the same courtesy. Steve Kruger. Well, I hope they do too, Steve. We need you, and we need your rants. So please don't kick the bucket just yet. Chris wrote in saying, thank you for your great show and all the advice you give us. My question is, how low do you think the euro will fall, and what will happen with the dollar in the future? It looks like quantitative easing will come, if not this year, then next for sure. Which major currencies is the best to buy these days? Thank you very much, Richard, and keep up the great work. Chris. Lots of questions there, Chris, but they all really come down to the same thing. I think the dollar is going to rise for the foreseeable future. I would not be looking for other currencies at this point. When the time comes, then I will not hesitate to give you my advice, but it's premature at this point, Chris. How low will the euro fall? Do you mean before it evaporates altogether? I think it will go to parity with the dollar. Yes, a lot of people said that, and I have no reason to doubt that that might happen. We're right now trading at 1.32¾, and think it could easily go to a dollar. As I said, the dollar will rise. QE, not so sure about that, Chris. You know, Ben Bernanke tried it twice. It was a disaster both times. Is he going to be the proverbial crazy guy who keeps doing the same thing, hoping for a different result? I think not, and I hope not. And I think the European Central Bank's unwillingness to do the same thing speaks volumes about what they felt about seeing QE2 and QE taking place in the United States and really not going anywhere, so don't think it's going to happen. Okay, Kevin Moran wrote in about the clip that I played you last week, or maybe it was Monday, I can't remember, of Ron Paul being interviewed by Bob Schieffer. And he has this to say, I haven't seen such an attack by a mainstream TV journalist ever. It was as if this interviewer was sent with orders. A few points. One, at first, I was surprised Ron Paul was being given prime time. Two, it was as if he was interviewing a member of the Communist Party or even the Hell's Angels. Three, the interview was short, just long enough to attack Mr. Paul. Kevin Moran. Well, that's an interesting and good analysis of the situation, I would say, Kevin. It was, of course, a horror story. I was cringing with embarrassment to hear it, and I hope you were too, ladies and gentlemen. And if you didn't hear it, then by all means go back to the first show at the beginning of the week, and you will hear Ron Paul being interviewed by Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation. It was a disgusting performance. Okay, let's finish off with Jed, who says, "We all enjoy your economic analysis very much. Will HSBC and Chase collapse?" Maybe not, maybe. I'm not quite sure how to answer that question at this point, Jen. "On a daily basis, my friends and I are reading very negative views, news regarding HSBC and JP Morgan Chase, where we all have savings and checking accounts. We understand that if there is a bank collapse, the FDIC insurance will mean very little, so what possible solutions are there to protect our life savings? Short 1 to 3 months treasury bills is an option the banks can do for us, since we don't want to do this ourselves through the internet, but then we started thinking that when the banks collapse, won't T-bills be a bigger risk since they're not FDIC insured? In addition, buying T-bills through a bank and the bank closes, what does that mean? Have we lost our money? Also, if banks collapse, won't that automatically mean the U.S. defaults and T-bills are worthless? Given these two scenarios, what is the safest thing to do? In other words, what is safest? FDIC-protected bank accounts or 1 to 3 months T-bills? Jen." Answer, go for the T-bills, Jen, and buy them through Treasury Direct. Okay, put in Treasury Direct, all one word, into your browser, and buy your Treasury bills with them. It goes straight to the Treasury, you pay less, and they will be the ones who reimburse you directly when they mature. All right, Jen, thank you very much for your question. We have, of course, come to the end of the show again, and it has been a pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. I look forward to talking to you again on Monday. You may now resume your long weekend and try to get over whatever debilitating effects Thanksgiving paid you yesterday. Take care. Talk to you on Monday. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye. Oh, and listen, please, for the next show, which is Johnny Miller with the Expat Files, talking about Latin America, coming right up. Bye-bye.